Welcome to the Dads on the Fly podcast. I'm Joshua Simmons. Dads on the Fly is brought to you by Trout Routes, the number one mapping resource for trout anglers. Turtlebox Audio, the loudest, most rugged outdoor speaker. And Catch Cam Nets, where you can build your own net.
And I'm Caleb Simmons. Thanks for joining with me and my brother as we discuss fly fishing, fatherhood, and faith, and the intermingling of it all. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 125 of the Dads on the Fly podcast. I'm Caleb Simmons with my brother Joshua Simmons, as always. And Joshua, how are you, man?
Doing great, man. We had a really cool weekend. Both Simmons families got to do some fishing. So you got to do some fishing on Friday. I could do some Saturday and Sunday. Double weekend on the water, which we're going to talk about in a future episode. But today, man, I'm just so excited. First of all, thanks to everyone who has checked out the video. If you haven't checked it out yet, make sure and go to Backwater Fly Fishing on YouTube. Jesse Mails' YouTube channel has the Dads on the Fly, Story of Dads on the Fly video, and we just got a great response from that this past week, man.
Yeah, man, it's been so cool to see the film kind of take shape, and just, again, thanks to Jesse for putting it out there, and thanks to everyone who's checked it out and left us some feedback. I mean, that's been the cool thing, is learning, hearing from lots of different people about the film or just about kind of their stories and their relationship to us. And so, if you haven't checked it out yet, go check it out. It'll be in this show notes on today's episode as well, or you can check it out on all of our socials, or we're still constantly putting it out there. So go check it out and let us know what you think about it. We'd love to get your feedback about the film. But Joshua, today I am very excited about our guest on today's episode. This is a really cool episode. We experienced our guest through a video that he was on by Wildfly Productions, and Wildfly puts out some amazing fly fishing YouTube films, and we heard about our guest from there, and then we reached out to him because he is a guy who kind of fits, like we say, the trifecta around here. He's a dad, he is a fly fisherman, and he is also a man of faith, and we talk about all three of those a little bit in today's episode. But then also what's really cool is just what this guy's created. So today's episode is with Dr. Bob Letta
of All Alaska Outdoors.
Dr. Bob has created this amazing place up there on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska, and he's going to share with us all about that.
Yeah, there's not a lot of places I've looked into in Alaska to fish, but I know which one I would go to if I could, because, Caleb, the more I talk about and look into doing trips, because I'm looking at some for us this summer, just that DIY aspect of it, man, and that's what you can do at Dr. Bob's Lodge. You can kind of do your own meals, set your own schedule, fish with his guys when you want to, and then, you know, you get that, if you do that package, you get that ultimate he talks about where he takes you on that, you know, that plane and just flies you all over Alaska, man, and just fishes you in some cool places. So definitely such an awesome opportunity to get to speak to Dr. Bob about kind of how he started the lodge and what it means to him to, like, be able to take people out on the water and continue to grow his business. So thanks to Dr. Bob for taking the time. Super, super fishy episode and a super dad episode, too. He did a great job.
Yeah, for sure, man. Hope you guys enjoy this conversation. Before we dive into that, just want to thank everybody who continues to leave us feedback on the show, continues to rate and review the show. Matter of fact, just this past Friday, as Joshua mentioned, I was out on the water and at the put-in, putting the boat in, and ran into a couple guys there at the put-in who listened to the show, and which was really cool. So it just always means so much to us whenever we get feedback from people who listen to an episode or they share it with a friend, and they let us know that it has a positive impact on their life. So thanks for all those who continue to do that. Those mean the world to us, and they kind of keep us doing what we're doing. If you haven't yet, please go rate and review the podcast, give us some feedback, and then, without any further ado, let's dive into today's conversation with Dr. Bob Letta.
Let's welcome to the show Dr. Bob from Alaska. Dr. Bob, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I mean, short days, cold, but at least the sun's shining and I didn't have to shovel snow for the last week, so.
Well, we've been complaining because we've had some really cold temperatures here in North Carolina lately, Dr. Bob, but I'm sure it's nothing compared to what you've got there on the Kenai Peninsula, isn't that right?
Kenai Peninsula.
Excuse me for saying that wrong. Yeah, the Kenai Peninsula. Dr. Bob, we're so thrilled that you're going to hang out with us for a little bit today, and we can't wait to dive into a little bit more of your story. We've seen your story. I'm sure a lot of people who are in the fly fishing community have possibly seen your story through what you did with Wildfly. They created a video with you all about your lodge, and It was very intriguing to us. Joshua and I were big. Joshua loves to plan trips, and so obviously, as soon as you know he sees that video, he's like, "We got to figure out how to get to Alaska." So we've got about 50 different trips planned that we got to get in before we die. I don't know how we're gonna do it all, but we will at some point, I'm sure. But Dr. Bob, thanks for hanging out with us tonight. We just want to hear a little bit more about your story and about just fly fishing in general in Alaska and where you're at and what you do. So to get it started, we'd love to just hear a little bit about how you came to be an outdoorsman. What is it that led you to love the outdoors?
You know, my dad and my granddad, fishing was probably genetically ingrained in us. You know, my grandfather was actually from Sardinia. So, you know, of course, Sardinia is an island and, you know, a Mediterranean island in Italy. And, you know, he loved to fish and he immigrated to New York and they lived in New York City and they fished Montauk quite a bit. And so my dad tells me the stories about, you know, surf casting for stripers and that kind of thing. And, anyways, he started me out fishing when I was three. I can still remember the first fish I caught when I was 3 years old. I can literally see it in my mind's eye. Now, it was a carp in a pond in New York, you know, but I remember it. You know, I remember that fish flopping, the bobber going down. I mean, that's, you know, isn't it amazing that a young brain like that, and it impacted me so much that I still can feel the day. You know, I mean, so it was, you know, that was it, man. I was hooked. I mean, that was the funnest thing ever. And it's just grown since then. We moved to Texas when I was about five. My dad got a 16-foot Boston Whaler. And being that he was pretty good outdoorsman himself as far as fishing, he never was a hunter. He started learning the ropes and reading and visiting and, you know, networking. And man, I fished probably 40 weekends a year growing up with my dad, you know, and the other 12 were dedicated to yard work, which was my punishment. But that's how, I mean, I just fished my whole life since I was little. And, you know, by the time I was probably 8 or 9, I was the kid that took other kids fishing, whose dads didn't fish. I mean, I became a guide at a young age, you know. I mean, I was close to waterways and I was in an estuary, Clear Lake, which is in the outskirts of Houston, has brackish water, bayous that drain into saltwater lakes that are tidally affected. And, you know, I mean, I used to, by the time we were old enough to ride bikes, I mean, I knew how to fish from my fishing on the weekends. I had my own poles and I would take the other kids in the summer. We, you know, our dads were at work. I'd drive them down to one spot or another and we'd fish for redfish or flounder or speckled trout or all three. We found bass ponds, you know, we started getting into float tubing and we'd fish bass ponds that were, you know, borrow pits, we called them, where they would dig the, you know, dirt out and eventually they'd scrape too low and the things would fill with an aquifer or clear water. And then they would eventually end up with stocked, you know? So that was kind of my childhood growing up fishing. I got very into bass fishing when I got into college because I moved inland away from the coast. And so I was fishing in around Conroe and Livingston because Sam Houston State University was between those two lakes. And so I really bass fished avidly as a college student. In fact, even though I was in pre-med, I chose all my class time so that I could bass fish every morning at daybreak. You know, I mean, I just and fished. And I typically, you know, as a pauper that you are when you're in school, you know, I ate a lot of fish because it was cheaper than buying chicken, you know, and you didn't have much money. So that kind of led me. And there I still was guiding, you know, I mean, I had a little 12-foot John boat and a little electric trolling motor and I'd throw it in the back of my pickup truck and I'd take the other college kids that didn't know how to fish. And, you know, I just guided my whole life. I mean, I was always wanting to share the experience of being in the outdoors with other people because it impacted me so greatly, you know? And so it was kind of like when I finally decided on going to medical school. The year before that, I was in college and one of my professors mentioned that he needed a deckhand on his commercial salmon fishing boat in Alaska this summer. And I was like, that's me. I'm like, I'm going. And so I ended up coming up in commercial salmon fishing in 1986. And, you know, I'll be honest, Alaska, as a kid who grew up in Texas, which is probably not a lot different. Well, we probably have more barbed wire fences than North Carolina, but I felt like Texas was a system of highway with barbed wire fences on either side. I felt like there was a lack of freedom. You know, it seemed like the natural resources, particularly on land, were all owned. And I was frustrated by that. And I got to Alaska, and I remember stepping off the plane on June 22nd, the day after summer solstice, 1986. And it was a beautiful blue sky day, 11 o'clock at night. The sun was just setting behind the Alaska Range, and I breathed in and I went, this is where I'm living. And I mean, I knew it just like you expect the sun to come up. I mean, I knew at that point that whatever avenue I followed from that point on, it was eventually going to lead me back to a permanent place here, because it didn't, I just thought, this is it. So then I finished med school and residency and managed to claw and fight my way up here when I could throughout that 7-year experience. I managed to do some medical rotations here in Alaska while I was in training. And then when I got out, I was just fortunate that they were looking for an ER doc here on the Kenai Peninsula, which was where I had commercial salmon fished. And I accepted the job and moved up here, and I bought a house, and I specifically was looking for a house on a float plane lake, because I'd gotten my pilot's license during my residency, and I wanted to make sure there was a lot on either side of it so I could build a fishing lodge next to my home. And that's what I did. And that was sort of shared in the wildlife story briefly at the very beginning, and more in a more expanded fashion in the podcast I did with them. Built the lodge, and you know, I kind of ran it like a doctor running a hobby farm, meaning I financed the lodge by being an ER doctor. You know, I wasn't that worried about whether it made money, just as long as I could keep it going, you know, because it was letting me fly airplanes and take people fishing and do what I love to do, which is guide. And quite frankly, I've converted people to Christ on flyouts before. I'm sure, I mean, I know for a fact, two of them, you know, just by discussing with them the absurdity of thinking that all this beauty and all the joy and emotion that we're wired to experience just exploded from nothingness for no reason with no design. And it's like you're flying over the Alaska Range and you tilt that plane up, make them look down at a glacier, and then you land them in the most beautiful places in the world, and you just keep kind of going, you really think this just exploded from nothing and there's nobody trying to impress you right now? I'm like, I just don't get it. And so, you know, that's kind of my why. I mean, I love to take people out and share, you know, what is probably one of the, you know, can't remember who the quote was, that basically said, you know, God must have done Alaska last after he had it figured out, you know. I mean,
so through all that, remarkable, so many follow-ups here, but when was the first time you got a fly rod? Were you fly fishing in Texas any, or did you just start fly fishing in Alaska, or was there a little combo of both?
You know, when I was a kid, I had a, you remember the old Eagle Claw rod where you could unscrew the handle and flip it over? So I had one of those my dad had bought me. So it could be my spinning rod or my fly rod. And a lot of times, like when the bluegills would get on the beds in those barrow pits, we would go pound them with dry flies, you know. I mean, but most of the time I was chucking, you know, plugs or touts for saltwater fish. And I didn't really, you know, bass fishing was conventional. And bass fishing to me was scientific. I when I was a bass fisherman, I mean, I read every issue of Bass, BASS, and Bassmaster magazine. I mean, literally cover to cover. I was trying to absorb all that science and learn how to pattern fish. You know, often thought, had I not ended up going down the Alaska road, I might would have strived to become a bass fisherman at a competitive level. But when I ended up in Alaska and it was like, okay, I'm done for now. I mean, this is where I have to live. I'm like, well, what's going to replace that scientific aspect of bass fishing? Not that flying airplanes in the bush and, you know, there's not enough technical, but I knew that fly fishing was going to fill that niche. And so then I really turned my attention to fly fishing. You know, I bought the Orvis fly fishing manual and I read it and learned it and learned how to do everything. And I started buying fly rods and I started focusing on fly fishing basically as soon as I got here, you know. And I tell people all the time, it's like, I'm agnostic when it comes to fishing. I will fish any way. You can put me on a bank in an Ohio farm pond with a cane pole, a bobber, and a worm. And if I'm catching crappie or bluegills, I'm going to be a happy person. But in any scenario, if I'm given the opportunity to fly fish over any other method, and it will be at all successful, in other words, if it's better than futile, I'm going to choose fly fishing because I don't need to catch any more fish. I've caught plenty of fish. So I don't mind catching less fish if I can do it with a fly. We all know that as we fly fish, if you've got to fish much, there is no closer connection to the power and experience of the fish than when you hook them on that fly rod. I mean, the energy is just transmitted into your being.
Oh, yeah.
So much better than when, like, you're holding a spinning rod and they're just peeling line off. Or, you know, I just can't, it's hard to explain, but you guys know what I mean. You fly fish.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we definitely can relate. And we try to explain that to people sometimes and not everybody gets it. But it is what, you know, I guess maybe there's something wrong in our brains. Who knows? Yeah.
So you build this, you're lucky enough to, or fortunate enough or blessed enough to get really the ER job of your dreams right there where you wanted to be.
Yep.
And, and you decide to build this lodge. And, early on, were you the sole guy? Like it was you, right? You were it.
Well, no, actually what happened was I had two different hunting dads that were friends of my dad who didn't hunt, and they had confidence in me as a human being. They were the age of my dad. And when I had said that I was interested in setting up a fishing lodge, they both said they would be interested in investing in that. So I had two partners in it. And when they were younger men, they used to come up and help, you know, I mean, they helped me build it. They helped me set it up. One of them was very skilled. He had his own private business. So he sort of helped with that domain. The other one owned a pallet company and was kind of like a super handyman. So he was very good with the physical plant. And I was kind of the visionary and the guy with sort of, I don't think I had any professional marketing expertise, but I think I just, God gifted me a little bit in that domain. And so that was me. Plus I was going to be the guy up here physically running it because they both lived in Texas. They were going to come up and visit and participate. And I was going to run it, and I was also going to be, you know, get to guide it too. So that was kind of how it all happened. But I've always been the president of the lodge since we've opened it. And, you know, I've always basically been the final determination of, you know, most of the decision-making, but with the courtesy of their input, you know, I mean, you know, but recently as they've gotten old enough to where they don't even come up anymore, the air charter service that we worked so closely with for all these years, we kind of visited about it. And I said, you know, what would you think about becoming a partner and buying out my old partners? I'd like to get them some money out of their investment. Yeah. And of course they were, the money's tied up in the investment. And at that point it wasn't cash flowing. Like we weren't giving ourselves money. We were just running it. It wasn't losing money. We were able to pay our employees and, you know, and we were expanding. So it was growing. I mean, it went from a 1-acre complex to a 4-acre complex, a one building to five buildings, you know, but you keep building debt and it just doesn't seem like it's to that point where, yeah, okay, we're going to start writing these checks to the sad part was we bought these guys out the year of the Wildfly video.
Oh,
and so it was so impactful to, well, first of all, it filled one of our shoulder seasons. And if you fill the shoulder seasons, you're like, wow, this actually turns out to be profitable. You know, everybody fills the middle of the summer when Alaska's busy, but the challenge is June and September. Well, all of a sudden now June is our most busy month. So it did a massive effect on our profit margin. And so all of a sudden my old guys that left me, you know, it's like, yeah. And then we just hit the home run, you know, and they actually were in, you know, they agreed with my strategy, which was total guess whether this was going to be an effective strategy or not. They blessed it. But then in the interim, it was filmed. And while we were waiting for it to come out, we did this transaction where Alan and I with Talon Air bought out my two old partners. And then after we transferred ownership to the new infrastructure, all of a sudden we hit this advertising home run. Yeah. And it seems like it's a long-term solution because, I mean, I'm still getting inquiries that come from the Wildfly videos at over a year out, you know? So that's
pretty impressive. So let's, I guess, because I don't want to talk about, well, I do want to talk about this all night. So we'll just do it now and see how long it takes. I just want to start with, if people haven't seen the video, I know a lot of listeners have, but you know, we have some folks that maybe are not as techie and don't watch stuff, but even if they have seen it, I want to go back over it. So what does it look like to come in there and fish? I know I was just on your website. You got 7-day packages, you got 5-day packages, but I want people to really understand because that's what to me, I mean, you've heard, you go to these fly fishing shows, you hear about come fish in Alaska, or there's a lodge here in Alaska, or you got this part of Alaska, or people talk about, well, I'm going up here to the grizzly bears, you know, the Alaska, all the things that make Alaska. I had never seen something, and that's why I'm drawn. I've decided if I can ever afford it, we're coming your way, because what you were able to, how you were able to do Alaska, and to me, so many different things. Like you got the, so talk about, you know, an average week, and when you look at your website, it shows it, but let's just start with the big thing. You got the boat. I mean, you got the plane, and you're flying, and it does, I don't know if everybody does that, maybe they do, but it didn't seem like, to me, that just seems so intimate. And that's an option for everybody who comes to your lodge, correct?
Absolutely. So I'm going to go back a little bit farther. You know, when I started in this industry, the bread and butter was the conventional fishing for salmon. We had strong king salmon runs way back then and the saltwater. And, you know, we were targeting the same people that most of the other road-based system lodges were. The typical Alaskan tourist that's coming up here to catch some fish while they're here and go home with some meat. And you're fighting for exposure to that portion of the you know, demographic that is most of what comes to Alaska. But I knew I was going to love fly fishing, and I was married to it quite early after I got started up here, you know, and I fell in love with flying when I got my pilot's license, and I knew that I wanted to offer remote fly fishing. And what I saw was that there was kind of a big gap. I mean, there was your typical road-based operation, not as expensive. Typically, you're doing your own thing on meals. You're staying on a road system, and you're going out and you're doing those basic conventional fishing trips, and maybe you do a fly out somewhere that's not too far away, you know. And then the next step was this giant jump to a remote lodge, and, you know, which is now a $12,000 a week price tag, you know? And I'm like, there's a niche in between there, a road-based lodge. So you don't have all the added expense of getting remote, being fed remote, okay? Because that costs a lot of money, because they got to feed the people who are feeding you too. Yeah. And they got to fly everything out, you know? And so I'm like, there's a niche. There's got to be people who would want to experience remote fly fishing, but can't quite stomach the turnkey price of a totally remote experience at a remote lodge with the port wine and the cigars at the end of the day. So I knew that there had to be a niche and that I could fill it better than most people. My old brochures, back when we did brochures, used to say, because you said it, versatility is our specialty. which is an oxymoron, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have a specialty that's doing everything, but that was our specialty. We, if you looked at any other peninsula-based fishing operation, nobody had the assortment of activities that I could offer. And part of it was because I'm about the only person that offers that all-day ultimate expedition, which is the premier trip where a plane takes off from a road-based destination, but flies you to a remote place, and the plane stays with you for the whole day. You're in control of a guide and a pilot for a day's experience. And yet, and that, even though there's more flying involved from the lodge to some of these places compared to the remote lodges, which probably don't fly that far, there's more flying involved. I can still offer that at so much less money. And I've been just shocked at how many fairly young people, 30s and 20s, call up and go, you know, until I saw your video, I just thought going to Alaska and on a, you know, and experiencing remote fly fishing was a financially unattainable goal. But I'm looking at your prices, and I mean, I could kind of, you know, this could be a trip for me.
Yeah.
So what happened was the Wildfly video, their audience was that niche. I mean, because their original model was DIY trips, right? So they got a lot of DIY followers. And their niche, their demographic was exactly the demographic that I was looking for to fill these two shoulder seasons, June and September, which also happens to be the best fly fishing, in my opinion. I mean, you can fly fish in July and August, don't get me wrong. I mean, but my really cool fly fishing experiences, the best ones are in June and then in September. That's so cool. Now I've got the Wildfly guys. They're going to basically expose how cool our September venue is. September and June are going to be our busiest months now. And now I just got to work on getting meat fishermen to come up and catch some halibut with me, you know?
Yeah. So I think that's what's cool about it. Seeing it is something, but how is it? So somebody comes to your lodge, you just got the one plane and you do all those, or do you have?
Well, we got so busy now. So my planes operated underneath Talon Air, who's my partner in the lodge.
Gotcha.
So to get out of me having to, you know, he's got that whole operation turnkey. He's got five dock hands. So I eventually put my plane under his 135 operation and leased it to him. And then he pays me to fly it. So it's a totally goofed up, you know, you're kind of like, it's so convoluted, but it works. Well, we got busy enough this last year that he bought another Beaver at the end of the year for the air charter service. And then another one came up and he went ahead and bought it. So we've got two more Beavers now. And then Talon Air has a Turbin Otter and a Turbin Caravan and a Turbin Beaver, which is primarily, those are fast planes, and they're primarily used for these shuttle spots that are close that we talked about, that all the lodges utilize, either Talon Air or Alaska West Air, for these single location drop-offs. But they don't have access to the all-day premier experience. Yeah. And so now we have two planes. I trained another pilot, and I've been training guides I got to get my intellectual property right. I've got probably close to 100 places I fish, and nobody knows what I do.
Wow.
So it's like, if I die, the algorithm's gone, you know? Yeah. So I have to teach the pilots where to fly, where to park, you know, how I tie the planes up at these different spots. Hey, watch out for that rock. I mean, you know, it's 20 years of existence, but I've been doing that now for a year and a half. And so next year, we're going to have two Beavers dedicated to doing these all-day trips. I trained up a great guide, Eric Locker, and he's a phenomenal fly fisherman. He's a great spey fisherman. If you follow him on Instagram, you'll be amazed at some of his Instagram posts for some of the big rainbows he catches. I mean, he'll be crushing it in April before they close the river for spawning, you know, hiking through 2 foot of snow for a mile to get to the river, you know, to go fish this little section where he knows these big rainbows are going to be pre-spawning. You know, he's an incredible fisherman. But so now we've got the infrastructure in place. And then a long time ago, we did all the fly out, all the ultimates went directly from the lodge. But the unfortunate thing was, as progress has occurred, the lake's gotten busier. And I don't know if you've heard of these things called wake boats, but
Yeah.
these are boats that are designed to make a wake big enough to surf.
Yeah.
And if you think that there's not people who are lower than a snake's belly and willing to make 3-foot waves on a lake that's a mile long and a third of a mile wide, you'd be wrong.
Yeah. Wow. That's
I
tight.
mean, so they're destroying my docks,
Yeah.
and I can no longer watch my plane be tied up to my dock. So we moved all the planes over to the other lake in Talon Air because it doesn't have public access and there's no skiing going on. So this lake has a boat launch at one end. Well, we're running out of dock space over at Talon Air, and we'd like to get back to doing our ultimates right, just walk down from the lodge. So thanks to the financial blessings of just having a couple of prosperous seasons in a row after COVID, we were sitting well enough capital-wise that we're putting in a brand new dock system that's all aluminum, plastic floats. When I built my original docks, I put styrofoam in there and got muskrats living in them, and they're sinking. So it was time anyways. So now we're going to have three docks with two beavers in between. And to solve the problem of the wake activity when the planes are on the lake, we've purchased lifts. So we lift them out of the water. So we're going to have both planes fired up, ready to go.
Awesome.
Alaska doors on both planes, and competent guides and pilots to take multiple groups out. So we'll have a little more depth in the for the
Gotcha.
ultimate. Now, the typical single location flyouts will still go 5 miles down the road to the Talon Air Lake, which is a different lake, and depart from there because that's a rotation. It's like 30 minutes back, 30. We just back and forth back. We call it the meat run. It's glorified taxi driving. You're flying clients and guides over and taking them to where we have boats, where we take people fishing shorter distances, where we're not too worried about, the weather's going to come in and we can't get them because there's a mountain range in between us and them. On the ultimate, I cross mountain ranges frequently. At least if I goof up, which happens every 2 or 3 years, and can't get back, we got a plane to sleep in.
Yeah.
You start going and dumping people off in the middle of nowhere, to go fishing, and then you can't get back and get them. That's a little bit like you got to kind of watch that.
So
So.
your ultimates, what are the amount of people that can go? Like, so let's just say you got a group coming or something. Like, how many can you fly in for like that full day? And then we'll kind of go into the other stuff you guys do.
Well, I mean, because of the depth of planes we have now, we could take 25 people on an ultimate if we had to.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be
But it'd be multiple planes and you'd ruin the experience when you got there.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I tell people all the time, I go, one of the benefits of the ultimate is that exclusive. And it's like, a party of four and a party of eight are going to be competing for the same amount of fish catching because eventually the bite's going to go off.
Oh, yeah.
I'll start playing musical flies and musical lures, when they start catching on to what we're doing. And then eventually you're like, all right, it's gotten pretty slow. Let's go to another spot. Well, if there's eight people, the total catch is going to be pretty similar. The catch per person is going to be half, So I always tell people, we can put a big group like, there's eight of you, and I get you guys want to stay together, and we could take the otter if you want, and I can let the beavers stay back and do its meat runs. Yeah, we can do that. It's like, but I got to be honest, when you take eight people there, you kind of ruin it for yourself.
Yeah.
So why not split up into two groups of four? But the ideal beaver load is 4 to 5 anglers with a pilot and a guide, or if it's five people and they're very big, then I do the guiding because I'm the only pilot that we have that also guides. So anytime one of the other pilots is going, he's a taxi driver with wings with no other skill set. I shouldn't say that. If they hear me, they'll go, "You rotten sucker, we can fish. We're not guides, So, I mean, well, they don't have the same skill set. So typically, if one of the other pilots is flying the ultimate, then it's going to be a dedicated guide taking up one of the seats, And truthfully, beavers start to get a little tight if you put more than four people behind the co-pilot and pilot seat. You can put five in there, but you'll have three people in the middle seat, and that's pretty tight on normal sized people. You know, if you had a 10-year-old, no problem. You know, a scrawny little 10-year-old, you know, sitting between you two, you guys would be comfortable. But you put another man your size in there, and you know, it starts getting tight.
It sounds,
you know,
like we can only invite two people to come with us. That's what it sounds. It sounds like it's just going to have to be a group of four. That's
a group of four is about ideal. A group of four is how the boats are configured, minus the halibut boats, which are usually six. The fly-in single location boats are sort of set up for four people and a guide. The ultimate is perfect for four. The upper river drifts can take four people unless you want a more exclusive trip. You can purchase, you know, you can take a three-person exclusive or a two-person exclusive. So four is a good number. That's a great number. I love parties of four. They work out real well in almost all domains, you know.
What kind of fish are, let's just let everybody know. So we're flying out. Obviously you talked about the salmon, but like what kind of fish when we're going on those fly-ins are we targeting?
So you got to think about this. That is like a long question, and we got time, and I'm, like I said, it's early here and late where you guys are. So you guys have the energy. So we're targeting multiple locations on either side of two different mountain ranges. So three, you know, bowls of water, right? Everything west of the Alaska Range, the waters between the Alaska Range and the Kenai Mountains, and the waters on the backside of the Kenai Mountains in the peninsula. All of these mountainous areas have multiple drainages. So there's hundreds of rivers, okay? They all have salmon runs, and they all have a variation in their you know, resident fish, whether they be Dolly Varden, grayling, rainbows. We've got lakes that were typically are what's forming the rivers that have char and lake trout and grayling and rainbow. So you've got, you know, we've got northern pike. So you've got all these different species, and then you've got the timing of their idiosyncrasies. You know, you've got the spring pike spawn, and you know, and you've got the fall char and lake trout spawn, and you've got the timing of the salmon runs. And so it's an extremely dynamic thing. So what I would say is in June, in the early part of the season, we're just starting to see some sockeyes return, and we can target some salmon. King salmon's kind of going the way of the dodo bird, so I don't encourage people to expect that they're going to catch a bunch of king salmon, at least not in flowing water. They might can go target them in the salt water on a you know, salt trip. But apart from a few sockeye salmon coming into the river, we're primarily targeting resident fish, and it's primarily catch and release. Yeah. So June's a great time for guys like us. Come up in June. You're not going to cry about that you didn't go home with 100 pounds of fillets. That wasn't the point of the trip, okay? You'll probably go home with some fillets because we're pretty good at getting you on some salmon, but the emphasis is going to be what's available for catch and release fly fishing. And in early June, it's the best time to come for big giant pike. And when I say big giant, you know, we caught a 44 incher this last year. You know, it was 25 pound fish, maybe 30. We caught lots of fish over 40, and it, you know, catching 32 to 38 inch fish are like the cookie cutters when you're fishing those fish on the bed. But somewhere between about June 10th and June 20th in the average year, those fish, they leave the spawning grounds and they go become solitary ambush predators scattered around these giant lakes. You'll never find them. Yeah. You might still can catch a pike, but I'm not going to have, you know, everybody catch a pike over 38 inches. So that's that. At the same time, grayling are already, they spawn in the spring. So they are very targetable in the flowing water, usually right below the outlets of the lakes. And we have tremendous grayling fishing. And the lake trout are always at what I think I've got it boiled down to is we fish these little inflow creeks into the lakes where the sockeyes have come and they've spawned the last year. So in the rubble, in that, in that gravel that's kind of going down into the lake where these rivers dump in, there's alvin and smolt that are hatching. And those lake trout know that, and they're always there in the spring. So we pound lake trout on the flies, right? And you saw that in the wildfly video. That's what we were doing. Well, what's happening there is those lake trout are there because the salmon from the previous year are hatching. So lake trout always good. We get into char pretty early because they will also be looking for these out migrating smolt, and they're capitalizing on it. So if the system has char, you likely get on those fish as well. And then rainbows, it's the same thing. On June 11th, that's the opening of flowing water for rainbow trout fishing. And that's statewide, which is odd because almost everything else is staggered and confusing. But you can start fishing flowing water for rainbows on June 11th. So that's the opener of trout. At that point, you can fish the local rivers for rainbows and Dolly Varden. And, of course, I can start targeting remote rivers that are flowing for rainbows. But oddly enough, they don't prevent us from grayling fishing those remote rivers. And you could kind of accidentally catch a rainbow while you're grayling fishing. It's not inconceivable over in some of those drainages. As the season progresses, those pike move out. I can always catch pike if you want high volume hammer handle fishing. There's lots of swampy lakes that are full of small pike that are easily accessible. The grayling fishing stays solid from ice out until I'm not tough enough to fish anymore. I mean, they're a great species to fish. The rainbows, about the same. It's tougher in the middle of the year for rainbows, particularly on the Kenai River, because the river's so saturated with food. There's millions of salmon spawning, and they're releasing, tens of thousands of millions of eggs, and you're down there hoping your bead gets noticed by one of them, I mean, so it gets tough in the middle of the season, for rainbows in the big systems. The sockeye, of course, by that time in July are coming in by the million. So if you want to fish for meat, you can target them with fly rods. You can, conventional fish them and just get it over with, I'm like, yeah, we're grocery shopping, and then, eventually we get to the late part of July where some of the streams that we fish start getting my favorite fish, which is silver salmon. And by mid-August, we have a number of different streams that are suitable for clear water sight fishing for silvers with flies. And by late August and September, my favorite fisheries, which are the two streams in the Bay of Pigs, where the wildfly guys will show you what that was all about, crank up. And of course, at the same time, throughout all of that, we have the capacity to take you out in the salt water and fish for halibut and lingcod and sea bass, and also fish for salmon. But that's typically going to be using groceries to catch groceries. I mean, now I'm sure there's some guy out there that's got a halibut charter or saltwater boat that does fly fishing exclusive trips, but I'm not trying to find that niche in particular. But there's probably a guy or two who's like, yeah, I'm a saltwater fly fisherman. That's not something that we're trying to really penetrate. I use the salt water for making the fish box heavy. But, because hey, look, if you guys come up here, I'm going to probably tell you, you sure you don't want to go home with, 100 pounds of like quality protein? If you do, the best bang for your buck is go out with those guys and drop those big weights down to the bottom with a herring on a hook and wait for a bite and then reel the heavy sucker in, and there's your food to go home with, right? We don't want to kill the 18-inch grayling that's 15 years old and get a piece of meat like that, and we just sacrifice that beautiful fish. We let all those go,
I like it.
So, man, so cool about all this. Just wanted to we want to transition just a second to some dad stuff and some things about your faith. But just for people who are listening that are out there, one other question that people might have, and I know, what does it look like travel wise? Like, I know remind us where you are.
Okay. So I'll give you the quick rundown. Like if somebody called up and said, well, so tell me about what it's like if I'm coming to your place.
Yeah.
Okay. So wherever you're departing from, you're going to need to get to Anchorage. And from there, the most common scenario would be to rent a car in Anchorage. Although you can book a commuter flight that'll end up running you another $300 a person round trip. But when you land in Kenai, you're still going to have to rent a car because we don't provide 6 vans to taxi you guys wherever you need to be. We got, 11 suites and everybody's going a different direction every day. I mean, I'd have to, we'd be back to the remote lodge price if I did that, So you handle your own transportation and you drive typically from Anchorage to the lodge, a beautiful drive. It's about 2.5 hours through the mountain pass, down along the Kenai River. You get to see the upper Kenai where you might probably be doing a drift trip, one day. And then you'll come down into the flats and paved road all the way to the lodge. You get to the lodge and you're going to be in a suite that's suitable for your group size or maybe multiple suites if you're, bigger. And that suite's going to have a full kitchen in it as well as grills on the property. And the way meals work is we do a gathering on either Tuesday or Wednesday where everybody at the lodge comes and we have a meet and greet and get to know in our clubhouse, which is also one corner of it's the office. Apart from that, you do your own thing on meals that lets you eat when you want, what you want, without having to pay me to cook something that maybe you don't want, which would also be a problem for me at a remote lodge. I'm a health and wellness specialist. And a lot of the stuff they're probably serving at the remote lodges is scratched off of my, preferred food choices. I eat healthy. And a lot of times at these places, their goal is not serve you the healthiest meal. Their goal is serve you that meal that'll make you come back again a year from now because want to eat the food too,
Yeah.
So I like the possibility where you can be autonomous on your meals. There's plenty of restaurants within 15 minutes of the lodge. There's a Safeway and a Fred Meyer grocery store 6 miles away. You're going to be bringing back fish. You can grill fish. You can buy a steak. Most people make a breakfast every morning in their lodge before their trip. They pack their lunch for the day, and then they either dine out or cook in their suite. So that's how the meal thing goes. Each day, you're going to be told where you need to be and at what time. Usually, we do a lot of Google Map pin drops now instead of printing instructions, which is a blessing. I think we're saving a couple trees. We used to have these thick, here was your
quest.
Now we do it all. Now we've got it all electronically handled, which is nice. And nobody loses their phone. You'd get a knock on your door. We lost our directions, and you'd be running over, printing another set. So this works out great. So you're going to be directed at where you need to be. Now, some days, now that we're going to put the beavers back, if you're doing an ultimate, you're just walking down and getting in the airplane at the new docks. If you're doing a river trip, you're going to be meeting the guides at one of the boat launches. If you're doing a single location fly out, you're going to be driving 5 miles down the road to the Talon Air dock. And if you're doing a saltwater trip, you're going to have an hour to an hour and a half drive to one of the saltwater boat harbors, which is not that close to us. We're kind of centered inland a little ways, So that's kind of how that goes down. Each day when you catch your fish, you bring it back to us. I have a wonderful fish processor. He's been with me for probably 15 years, I guess. He does a phenomenal job. He's super fast, does a great job, cleans them up beautiful, vacuum seals them in 7-mil bags, flash freeze them to 10 below, put them in an airline-improved box, and that's ready to go home with you when you leave. And whatever price that we quote you at the end, all of that's included, including all of the equipment. We encourage fly fishermen to come with their own chest waders because we only provide hip waders, and you sort of hamstring yourself if you can only get to hip wader depth. You might find a spot where you can't cross the river. And so I like my ultimate participants to show up with some breathable, light chest waders. I'm agnostic as to whether they bring their own fly fishing gear or not, because I've got a quiver for everything and it's all rigged up for whatever I'm targeting right now. So it's almost more work for me if you bring your own rod. Well, I'm certainly not discouraging people. I'm more than happy to, you know, myself or the guide, get your rod rigged up. You know, I mean, I'm not going to tell some guy who ties his own bamboo rods, don't bother me with that. Here, this is already rigged. I mean, we do what you want, but we'll get a little bit more fishing in and waste a little less time if we just, you know, I could show you. Now, this was probably, looks to me like I was fortunate this day. And I had the kind of people that said, yeah, you don't need to bring anything, but,
oh gosh, yeah,
but fly rods. But imagine that I'll have a day where I've got that quiver of fly rods or even more. And a full set of heavy spinning rods and a full set of light spinning rods. I mean, it's like crazy looking. And I probably got a picture of that somewhere. That's but wild. So, you know, it's like, I'm not going to discourage people from bringing their own stuff. I want them to catch fish on what they want. But it is funny. A lot of times people will, they'll bring their own fly rods. And then, you know, you start handing the rigged out ones to the other guys and they'll kind of look at theirs and they'll go, they throw it back in the float hatch and go, I'll just take one of those, Doc. You know? Yep. Yep. Good enough. You know, I mean,
for sure. For sure. Well, Dr. Bob, this has been incredible learning all about your lodge. And we just want to encourage people, if they're interested in it, to go check it out. AllAlaska.com is where they can go find everything. They can see all about these incredible trips. They can learn more about what it might look like to book a trip on their own. And we encourage them to go check it out. Before we get off, though, I wanted to spend just a few minutes asking you about just some more kind of personal stuff, because you hinted at a lot of it with your story. And you can just tell from your passion on what it is with this lodge. You know, you fell in love with Alaska. You have a real passion and desire for just teaching other people about it, for teaching other people about fly fishing, from taking them in the plains. I mean, you talked about that, just showing them the beauty of that place. Why do you think you enjoy that so much, of just sharing it with so many people?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back to God on that one. I think, you know, I just think that's the way God, that's who he made me. I mean, he made, you know, God wants us to share and have fellowship. And when you become good at something that is so inspiring to other people, you're driven to share it, you know? I mean, and I feel that way. And it's the same thing in my health and wellness practice. You know, I have behind me a library of books that are about longevity and how to prevent disease. And you know, when I shifted away from emergency medicine and started to focus on, you know, just, hey, let's try to come up with a strategy for taking a little better care of ourselves, you know, that's what I really want to learn about now. I don't really want to learn about how to treat disease. I want to learn about how to teach people not to get diseases, you know. And I have that same level of passion. I mean, one of the things that people do sometimes is come to the lodge and see me as a patient. I'd love for your clients, if they're, particularly if they're an older angler that's starting to worry about how many more years does he have left in him to maintain the level of physical strenuous, you know, fishing's not, I mean, you know, it's not like trying to shoot a, you know, a bighorn sheep in Colorado, but I mean, it can be strenuous, you know, it requires physical capabilities and coordination and, you know, and your faculties to be alert. And, you know, there's things we can do to maintain that longer. And so if anybody's interested in my approach to medicine, which is Christian based, you know, drbobslongevity.com is where I explain my medical practice paradigm, which is kind of going from the reactionary, you know, symptom driven. Okay, well, you're having a symptom. Let's see if you have the problem too. Let's get ahead of it and see if you have the substrate through elegant testing that makes it look like you're gonna develop the problem, and let's start to head it off before you've got end organ damage, you know? So that's what I do in my 8 months that I'm not fortunate enough. I mean, I have to sit this leather chair for 8 months a year, and it's frustrating because I want to be outside. but that's what I do for 8 months a year while I'm trying to also market the opportunity to be, you know, granted the immense privilege of having people put their confidence in me to get in an airplane with me, fly across a mountain range, you know, potentially through sketchy weather, but with a skill set that I understand what I'm doing, take them to the most amazing places God gave us to enjoy and get to share that with them and to have that privilege. You know, I just feel like I'm blessed beyond belief. And I just know I have to give back. And one way I can give back is by giving everything I've got in me to make sure that when somebody puts their faith in All Alaska Outdoors Lodge to show them a good week, we do our part. And boy, if I realize we've goofed up, I want to know what I can do to make it right. And we're never perfect. Nobody's perfect. There's no way you're going to have a fishing lodge with, you know, 400 clients in one summer and not have a few goof ups on our end, a clerical error, something, you know, we forgot something. I mean, it happens, you know? So, I mean, I know we're not going to be fault free. And that's the second part of, you know, integrity is accept your mistakes, accept responsibility, and do what you need to do to make it right. And that's the way we perform here, I hope.
For sure. Well, you can definitely hear that passion that you have for teaching it to other people. And, you know, it's come off in our conversation today, and I encourage anybody to go check it out for sure. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, which I just thought was really cool about your story. You talked a lot about the fact that your dad kind of got you into the outdoors, and then you had, you called them your hunting dads, who really kind of believed in you and supported you when you were early on with this idea of this incredible lodge. What do you think the benefit, or let me just ask, what does it mean to you to have older men like that who were helping develop you and allowed you to be the success that you are now?
You know, those two, one of those two men is in the list of the five most influential men in my life, right? I mean, one of those is my granddad. That was the one I was, that I got to spend the most time around because one of them lived in New York most of his life. So it was a visitation thing. The other one lived with us 6 months a year after his wife died for most of my childhood. He was very impactful. He was my baseball granddad. The other granddad was my fishing granddad. And I don't want to, I mean, you know, I love you both the same, you know, but I mean,
absolutely.
That one.
Was no, I understand. I, yeah.
You know, and then my dad, of course, because if we're not impacted by our dads, my dad took me fishing, you know, 40 weekends a year or something from the time I was 5 years old. I remember he used to tell the story when he realized that I was a better fisherman than him, you know, he goes, he used to say, I taught him everything he knows. And then I realized I taught him everything I know.
You know? Yeah.
You know? That's good. And that's the gift that you get to give kids, you know. You can teach them everything you know. And then someday, I still remember when my son, who's now an electrician, came over and fixed a problem for me. And I was like, I never thought you'd ever been useful for anything. So that, and one of those, that hunting dad, one of those hunting dads, he was my dad. When I was about 14 years old, I expressed a desire to hunt to my dad. He said, Bob, you know, I grew up in New York City. I mean, I grew up on the stoop, Bob, you know, I mean, yeah. I was like, what do I hunt? I mean, you know, I'm trying not to get beat up by Bruno, you know, I mean, I didn't get to hunt. We went down fishing. I know nothing about hunting. Well, he had a friend at his work that he knew was a hunter, a bow hunter. And he asked him if he would be willing to take me under his wing for hunting. And that dad became my hunting dad. He bought me a bow for my birthday when I was 14. And I used to go over to, he didn't live too far away. So I used to, my dad would drive me over to his house and we'd shoot arrows and practice. And I mean, you know, and then he ended up investing in a fishing lodge and we had a 15-year experience. And he still comes, you know, he still comes up here for about a week in the middle of the summer. And, you know, just to put the sockeye salmon away. And of course we package all his fish for him and all of that. And we stay in regular email contact. And I'm still in pretty close contact with the other gentleman. The three of us went on an elk hunt when I was 18, which was the first time I ever shot I shot little whitetails before, but that was the first time I shot a big animal, you know. You know, they were both good Christian men. And it was amazing. I mean, I'd be a different person if it wasn't for those two guys. I'd have probably never had this lodge if it wasn't for those two guys. I don't know if I would have, you know, fresh out of residency, coming up would have really, really pushed the ball over the top of the hill and let it start rolling down if I didn't have that extra motivation and some support from a couple of older guys that I knew, you know, had faith in me. And just the, like you said, the fact that they were willing to invest their own money in helping me with the startup money to build this project and had confidence in me to do that made me more confident in myself, you know?
I think that's really cool. And I think that just shows the importance of having people like that in our lives. And then, you know, when you get the opportunity, and I think that's what's great about your story too, is that now it's kind of coming full circle. You're getting to do this for other young guys. I mean, like you were just saying, you're taking guys and teaching them how to fly planes and showing them where to land them and where to park them and teaching them how to have this great experience for other people. And so I just think that's a really cool thing to observe just from this end of it, is seeing how, you know, this generational thing of just these guys investing in you and now you investing in the next generation and how it's just making an impact for so many people.
Yeah. Eric Locker, and those of you that like to follow Instagram, he's AK Trout Spay, I think is his handle. Let me double check here to make sure I don't lie to you, because
we'll make sure to find it and we'll put it in the show notes.
Eric Locker, AK Trout, he's a wonderful Christian guy. He walked down. It was like God put the two of us together and it was meant to be. And I feel so blessed because here's a young Christian man who is substitute teaching, and he was helping with a Christian summer camp. That's what he did in the summers, but it lent him to be able to move into this, which was much of more of a passion for him. And I don't want to feel like I took him away from Christianity, because I didn't. He's still very, very much, I have no concern about his faith and that well-being in that department. But to know the impact I'm having on his personal financial well-being now by giving him this amazing opportunity to guide people and you know, make a decent gratuity. I mean, the amount of money that he made last summer, and he's got two little kids, and I mean, you know, that's a bigger gift than anything, you know? I mean, that is, you know, makes me more emotional than just about anything else I can think of, is knowing that I've had a positive impact in his life, you know? And I think he's going to end up, quite frankly, he's the kind of guy where I go, you know, someday I got to pass the baton and somebody's got to start running some of this stuff for me. And, you know, he's kind of the guy I expect it's going to be him, you know?
So, Dr. Bob, just in saying that, and, you know, me and Caleb talk a lot, and people who listen to our show know we have guys that we have on this show that are great guests, and we say that they're awesome. We've had people from all walks of fly fishing and all walks of life. We always say our home run guests are guys that fit the three things that we really try to push in this podcast, and one is definitely fly fishing, which we've talked about, and the other is men of faith, which you fall right in there. And then the third is fatherhood. And, you know, as cool as everything we've talked about tonight, you are the father of five awesome children. You were telling about us, you were bragging about all of them off air. And so what does it mean to you? I think there's two parts to this question. Number one, how has your faith just impacted all of this through being this real successful lodge? But you can just see your passion to me, and you can just tell that, you know, this is a man who believes strongly in his faith. And secondly, how does that faith impact your business life, but also your fatherhood, that you're doing all this, but you're raising these five kids, and you bragged about them so much, so we know how awesome they are. Just talk about those two things and how they go together.
Well, I'll tell you, I try to lead off every day reminding myself. I mean, I have a few different email inboxes that lead me right to my scripture first thing in the morning. You know, I let other people direct me to maybe what I should think about that day. But I always try to spend time at the end of that asking for the Lord to do with me today whatever I want. You know what? I don't think he has total control, and probably for none of us, you know, I mean, but I really want him to have total control. And that's what I pray for. And I ask him for direction, and I remind him that I'm thick-skulled, so try not to be too subtle about it. And then I try to lead my life, you know, I mean, with what would Jesus do sort of mentality, you know, at every turn. And I truly want my life to impact. I want my life to make the planet better. I want it to be better for my kids. And I try to use one thing that I use, I call it gratitude instead of attitude. Now, you know, you hear the term attitude is everything, but in the sense, the way I'm using attitude here is attitude, you know, like, am I getting an attitude? And so if I develop an attitude about something, which means that I'm receiving stress from the thoughts in my brain, getting a tude, right?
Yeah.
I try to figure out where in this environment that is giving me this attitude, can I be grateful instead? What about that person should I be grateful about? Forget that dinner wasn't ready when I got home. How about go sit next to your wife and do the dishes that are stacked up in the sink by the grandkids and rugrats and the laundry she's doing, and think about she probably worked all day also, or dinner would have been ready. And while she's sitting there preparing dinner, get the dishes out of her way and be gracious that you have the opportunity to do that next to your beautiful wife. The other day, I had a long day. I think I finished. I'd do a few shifts for urgent care to help the ER docs have some time off in the winter. And I'd done an urgent care shift. I got home at 8:30. I literally sat on the couch. My son, Brett, Dad, would you cut me up a plate of fruit? My first thought was, yeah. I got up. I went in there. I hadn't quite gotten rid of the attitude yet. And then I opened the refrigerator, and Suzanne had just finished shopping. And I pulled a beautiful box of strawberries out here in Alaska, you know, and a nice banana and a beautiful Honeycrisp apple. And I sliced them up. And I put his whipped cream on it because, you know what? I'm blessed that my kid thinks dessert is a Honeycrisp apple, 5 strawberries cut in half, and a banana with whipped cream on it, because he's actually eating pretty healthy for a 13-year-old.
For sure, even, yeah.
You know, and so it went from I'm having to sit here cut up fruit after my long day to I'm so blessed that the Lord has put us in a position as humans that we're so smart that we can produce all this wonderful food and nutrition for ourselves. We can scatter it all over the planet and even get a fresh strawberry to Alaska in the middle of winter, you know? And I get the privilege of cutting this up for my son and then bringing it to him and knowing how it's nourishing him. And that's just how I try to live life. And you know what? If you can work that into your thought processes, the more you do, the happier you will become. And, you know, I mean, it's just the end of the day, that's the key to happiness, in my opinion. If you always try to figure out how to make the other person better, the wealth God showers upon you just keeps surprising you, you know?
For sure. Well, Dr. Bob, we can't thank you enough. This has been wonderful. It's been a great opportunity.
And a blessing, man. Really, yeah, has really been a blessing just to spend an hour talking with you. I feel truly blessed to just get to hear and learn from you.
Well, I sure would love to have you guys up. You guys got boys, I guess, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've got
two. Like brothers.
We are brothers.
We're brothers.
We're brothers.
Okay. I figured as much.
Yeah, and I've got two little boys. Joshua's got a 11. Is he, golly, how old is he now? I can't ever keep
My son's 12. Well, but to be honest, I don't know. If I did something like what I'm looking on your website, that might be a kid-free trip, because I don't want to – I don't know. Not to say I don't want to, but, you know, it's one of those things where I don't know how well he'd deal on a plane all day, and I guarantee if I'm coming, we're doing that.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure. So, yeah, but it's definitely something it's one of those – trips that's on the list for sure, and we encourage everybody to go check it out if they're interested in something like that.
It's on the list. Just that public school educator and pastor life just has to. We got to get people to listen on Dads on the Fly. That's what it is.
Listen, we're growing the show with the demands of trying to pay for trips. That's what we're
doing. There you go.
So that's what
we're doing. Well, I hope you guys are, I wish you guys great success, and I've enjoyed visiting with you. And, you know, I don't know, I don't know how to follow podcasts, ironically enough. And part of it is I got, you know, I spend so much time, you know, reading intellectual property on science of longevity. And it's like, I don't really have time to do podcasts, you know.
Oh, no, I understand.
YouTube, and so I got the big screen TV in the house. I can go on YouTube and I can watch a YouTube video and stuff now and then. But I do have a ton of audio books, but that's what I spend a lot of. I don't actually read books, I listen to them.
Oh, yeah.
But I buy the books if they're good so that I have a reference. I can look at the bibliographies. So it's been a pleasure talking to you guys. I can tell you guys are, you know, trying to plant the seed of take a kid fishing, and the outdoors is a great place to see the Lord. And you know, I mean, and you know, they're probably not in trouble if they're fishing next to you, you know.
It's a very good point. Well, Dr. Bob, thank you again for your time tonight, and thanks everyone for checking out this conversation with Dr. Bob Letta of Alaska, or All Alaska Outdoors. And until next time, tight lines.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dads on Fly podcast. We hope this conversation has inspired or encouraged you as a parent or an angler.
To learn more about Dads on the Fly, you can find us at dadsonthefly.com or at Instagram or Facebook at Dads on the Fly.
Yeah, we'd always love it if you leave us a rating or review, as it helps get our word out about the podcast. And if you like this episode, make sure to shoot a message and share it with a friend.